This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Hey, y'all.
Good.
How are you? I'm doing good. I'm coming down. I just came off a little bronchitis, so if I, you know, bark, forgive me. You can have to mute it out.
Everybody was basically saying that you had your own vision. This was you, and you knew what you wanted, and really, no one really was going to change it. Have you found that when you write something that it's so passionate and that it rings true for everybody?
Well, I guess at least in this case, the idea was more therapeutic more than anything. I was kind of going through a difficult time, trying to get Hustle and Flow going, and I was on a plane ride actually when Russell Simmons was actually interested in doing Hustle and Flow, and they were flying me out, but I didn't have any money. And my wife and I just had a baby, and we had just applied for state health insurance so we could have the baby. We were not doing too well. And my dad died of a heart attack at 49, so that was always on my mind. But I had this really intense anxiety attack on a plane, and you know, the stewardess came by, and I told her that, you know, you may want to get the defibrillator ready because I think I'm having a heart attack. And she asked me if I had any anxiety about flying or anything like that, and I said, no, ma'am. But my dad did die at 49, get the defibrillator out. And so she kind of talked me down, and it went away. So I didn't know really what it was. But as soon as I got back on that plane heading back home, it hit again. And there was a good month where I kept that from my wife, and finally I confided with her that it was happening to me. And that's when she told me that it was happening to her. And that it happened on freeways near big semis, that she would just feel like she was going to come out of her skin. And so we named it. I named it. We called it Black Snake Moan. So if we would be somewhere and they would begin to hit, we would kind of mouth that to each other, and we would have certain ways that we could get rid of the anxiety attacks through each other. Like if we were apart, I would call her, and all she would do is just talk like, you know, nothing bad is happening. Like, here's what we did with your son today. But when we were together and they would really hit me, she would lay on my back, and I would lay on the floor, and she'd kind of put her arms up underneath my chest and kind of like really push down, and that pressure would take away some of that anxiety. And I don't know, you know, not that it's your, you know, position here today to tell me that if you've had an anxiety attack, but for a confident person like myself, it really messed with me, that something could really drop me to my knees and me think that I'm about to die. There's a very unique time where you really begin to question your own mortality, and the first thing that, you know, she recommended I do was write about it. And there was a night where I just I needed to tune out a little bit, and I went to my room and lit a bunch of candles, and I started playing Skip James. I'm a big blues fan, and Skip James had this song, Hard Time Killing Floor Blues, and Washington, D.C., Hospital Room Blues. Those were the two songs I was listening to over and over again. And I had this this vision in my head of me going to my granddad's house in the country, and going through that front door, and this chain was just zipping past me as I was kind of going in through the door, and it was wrapped around this big old radiator that was kind of like, you know, right there in front of the door on the wall. And I just remember, like, I could feel an anxiety attack coming on, because I just knew that radiator was going to be ripped out of the wall. And I just remember just feeling like, oh shit, like, I shouldn't be writing about this, I shouldn't be thinking about any of this, because here it comes, you know, the Black Snake Moan is about to hit me again. And then this chain went taut, and it just, that radiator held. And as I was, like, looking at this radiator, and it was yanking and yanking and yanking, and dust and rust is flying off this thing, like, it went away. And I began to feel a little better, and I think I was in need of my dad, you know, I just needed to be yanked back a little bit, you know.
When you put this story together, you know, how did you come across Christina Ricci if you're leaving?
I actually, you know, the cool thing about Hustle and Flow is that this script kind of went out into the Hollywood pool, and really everybody was responding to it. Everybody wanted to be a part of it. But the problem with Ray, the character Ray, I I felt like I'd know it when I saw it. I mean, you all saw the movie. I mean, like I met her halfway on that. That was like on the script, but otherwise, that's Ricci. Because a lot of people that I had met with thought that it was just about being sexual, and that's not what the whole story is. Ricci demanded to audition, and I said, absolutely. I mean, I'm a fan of her work, but I had a certain, you know, I'm trying to embrace all these, you know, Southern archetypes and the whole iconography of Southern culture, and that includes drive-in movie, you know, the horny farmer's daughter, you know, don't go over there, she'll get you, that type of, you know, Lil Abner, Sadie Hawkins daydream, you know. And I didn't really see Ricci in that particular, you know, style necessarily, even though I'm a huge fan of Christina's. But she was my first audition, and I'm coming up the stairs of the casting department, and there on the steps is this, you know, little girl with a jean skirt on and a teeny little tank, and she had bought some blue eyeshadow from Walgreens, and she called up a friend in Mississippi and had her repeat all the lines to her on tape. And so we rolled the videotape, and just recently I saw it, and it's like a teeny stone's throw away from her final performance. Where everybody else had tried to be sexual or provocative, her character was like a 13-year-old immature daughter yelling at her mother, and then suddenly she'd be like very wise beyond her years and very seductive, and then she'd be vengeful and screaming and yelling at you, and then she would just drop to the floor weeping like a little toddler. And that's when I realized, like, that's what I've been missing. You know, I couldn't see anybody else but Christina. And she transformed herself. We spent about 45 minutes a day putting freckles on her. We were watching TV. I was watching TV in a hotel, and I saw Britney Spears doing a concert. And I called her up, and I said, look at her hair. She said, I get it. You know, we're crafting you know, no offense to Britney, but kind of like this white trash dream, you know. God. You know, press just gets you in trouble, doesn't it? Or maybe I get myself in trouble. But that, you know, she even went out to Dillard's in the South, and I don't think they have Dillard's out here. I don't know, but you know, insisted on getting the right white cotton panties. You know, it had to be just right. She chose her own chain, had about five different chains laid out for her, and wouldn't you know it, she picked up the biggest, heaviest, gnarliest chain, biggest padlock kind of thing that you put on the back of a trailer. And she just owned it. Like from that day on, like I couldn't see anybody else. And now when I watch the movie on so many levels, because I am embracing this kind of tone, which is a lot like a Tennessee Williams play or a short story by Flannery O'Connor. You know, these are authors and a particular type of performance that I don't think is really seen in cinema these days, because I think people usually need categories, and I like people to laugh at the outrageousness of it and also be moved.
Is there a concern that you might be typecast as the Southern director who will only think you would tell those stories? Is that something you welcome?
Oh, I hope so. As a matter of fact, I'm very proud about that. I would really like to represent my region. It seems to me that the one thing that we're missing right now in films is a regionalism. I look at some of my favorite directors. I mean, you know, let's look at Spike Lee's films, even from his small films to, you know, The Inside Man. There's an intense inspiration from jazz. He is a jazz filmmaker, I feel. There's times that you'll be watching something and it's obviously part of a narrative strain, and then it just kind of gets almost like a little improv. Suddenly it's like somebody just came in with a new instrument and they're kind of riffing on a clarinet. I think that comes from Brooklyn. You know, I think that comes from his dad. I think that comes from living where he's living. I think the, you know, same thing could be said about Alexander Payne from where he is. I think the same thing about Robert Rodriguez. I think the same thing about John Singleton in South Central. I really feel empowered and inspired by Memphis musicians. We have a history of not having much and trying to do a lot with it, and we're not really professionals. You know, Jerry Lee Lewis is not a good piano player. He isn't. But he plays it a certain way, and he bangs on that piano a certain way, that's Jerry Lee Lewis. If you gave him a Bach cantata, he'd make it sound like a Jerry Lee Lewis Bach cantata. Howlin' Wolf is not the prettiest sounding voice in the world, but, you know, with the right microphone in front of him and the right guitar and the right song, he's magic. And so I want to be considered a Memphis filmmaker, even if I do something that takes place in Alabama. It's why I continue to live there. It's why I continue to be inspired there.
Sam,
yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry, real quick.
Okay.
I'll get you. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned a movie that you were playing around your head called Captain Crossroads. I believe it's the full title of it.
That's what?
At the Crossroads, you had mentioned that you wanted to do this movie about four iconic Southern musicians being at the Crossroads.
Oh, you're talking about a long time ago. That Devil Music. Yeah, that's the rock and roll movie. That's just, you know, it's
still playing in your head.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's written, and I mean, I've even got people that want to be in it, but it's pretty expensive, so I'm holding off on that until the next one's Maggie Lynn. The next one's the country music movie, and that's all written and studios, you know, studio loves it, and we're just going to be getting into that. And then the soul movie. I really want to tell the story of that time in Memphis between the, you know, December of 1967, when Otis Redding went down in the plane crash with the bar case, through the sanitation strike, and when Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis in April 4th of 1968, is a very important time in soul music. It's when, you know, Mavis Staples and Isaac Hayes and all these people, musicians who lived in a truly integrated, successful studio in Stax in Memphis, began to see that, you know, they didn't want to be singing happy songs anymore. And that's the soul movie that I'm currently developing right now.
Sam told us about scenes where he's reading the Bible and an ad-lib about, and a white girl too, that you took out of the film. Can you talk about those scenes and anything else that we might see on the DVD?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's a beautiful scene that I just had to trim, where Sam Jackson, when he's trying to take the fever away from Christina in the tub, when he fills the tub of ice and pardon me, and water, that he reads what he read out there in the Bible, and it's from Matthew, when Jesus is healing the sick, and Jesus says, you know, if ye have faith as in a grain of mustard seed, then you can say unto the mountains, move hence, and they shall move. And, you know, the movie was just going a little long, and more so, I really didn't want to beat people over the head with particularly Christian imagery, just because I felt that the movie had plenty of biblical metaphors in it. And I just wanted it to be something where it's like, it's not so much that I'm trying to beat a religion into people as much as he believes it. It's something that is meaning something to him. And that's why it didn't make it into the movie. But there's a lot of great scenes that are going to be in the deleted scenes. I went through them last night, and really you could cut a whole new movie called The Last Temptation of Lazarus.
Do you think Sam brought into the film that you don't think you've seen enough of his other films?
Two things, really. There is a subtlety that I feel in this movie. There's one shot that I can watch over and over and over again. It's when she first stands up to reveal the chain. And he looks embarrassed. He looks a little awkward. And it's great to see someone as towering and powerful as Sam do something that restrained. And you see how much he suffers in his eyes, like when his woman tells him, I don't love you no more. Sam's kind of known for, you know, being the big action guy. You know, we there's certain things we love Sam to do. You know, that's why we can do iconic impersonations of Samuel Jackson. You know, because he's our American actor. You know, we like seeing him do the Sam thing. But in this movie, he really worked to create a character from some of these bluesmen that we put him in touch with in northern Mississippi. If you watch, he actually even holds his posture a little bit differently. I just watch him change, where he kind of push his gut out just a little bit more than usual, and his posture would just change. But the thing that I find most, other than the obvious, which is like he plays the blues and really, like, people probably have been waiting for Sam to play a blues, and he's so perfect for it. But more so, I really liked seeing him in a romantic situation with Esapetha Murkerson. When you see it with a full house, they're rooting for him. And that's a respect that someone like Jackson has basically earned over the years. And I think that we never get to see him be romantic. And it's really great to an audience really respond to that. You know, they haven't seen him do that. And they want him to be happy. They want him to find love.
Can you
I think podcasting just been.
Oh, I was just wondering, John was telling us earlier that there's been some threats that you had to deal with from the Aryan Brotherhood about this movie. I guess a lot of people are saying different things in it.
Well, I mean, it's hardly worth to give ink to, but yeah, I've been on a few blogs, but of course there's people that are not pleased with any notion of a black man needing to help a white woman. And it's really funny because this movie plays in the South and it plays like gangbusters, and that's because we're not particularly interested in the whole racial element to it or even the question of gender. Everybody there, I think, really kind of gets it. It's a ride that needs to be treated as a tale. It's a fable. Hate groups like that, the best thing I could say to some of those hate groups is, they're kind of played. They're just played. I mean, they're boring. We've got a long way to go, but boy, have we moved past that bullshit,
Tell us about Justin Timberlake. You told you to go back a little bit with him. You really wanted him in that part.
Yeah.
Yeah,
even before Hustle and Flow happened, when I was just making movies in Memphis on my video camera, I remember seeing him in interviews back when he was just about to leave NSYNC, and it was right before he started to record Justified. And I remember turning to my wife, just saying, I think I'm supposed to work with Justin Timberlake. She was like, really? Why? And I was like, he's up in Millington, and I think I really want to try to rep my region. I mean, that's why David Banner's in my movie. How many L.A. movies are there with L.A. rappers? Well, there's no Southern movies with Southern rappers until I came around. And so, I believe in just pulling all the artists together from my region. And the more that I talked with Justin, the more I realized that he was the only person that I could really go to on this. We both have really thick Southern families, and we've always been kind of like dealing with the fact of how far do you run away from your own heritage and your own Southern background. But we knew characters like Ronnie. We knew young men who had been pushed into very aggressive masculine roles by their family, and having uncles and fathers smacking them around, calling them sissies or faggots just to make them harder, and they're not equipped for it. They're not like that. They're not necessarily killers to go into war. And I've seen it destroy men. I've seen it just make them crumble and break inside. And Justin had observed that with people in his life. And Justin's a very confident young man. I mean, almost wise beyond his years in a spooky way. And so, I think it's a testament to Justin that he's taking this route with his career. He really could do kind of like a big tentpole production with him in the singing and dancing as the lead above the title, but he's choosing these roles where he's a supporting character and surrounding himself with really good actors. Also, he's made three movies. I've made three movies. We're starting off, and I like that we're young and fresh and trying something new. And I guarantee you, there's going to be a time like 5 to 10 years from now, Justin's going to be a movie star.
So you were impressed with his acting?
I do. I was. I mean, this is not an easy supporting role to play, especially to be that vulnerable.
Do you think the South is characterized by Hollywood movies? And I'm curious, what do you think when you see a picture like, say, Cold Mountain, made by Minghella, starring an Australian and a Brit? Does that feel inauthentic to a native Southerner?
I don't know. I loved Cold Mountain, but the problem is everybody in the South read Cold Mountain. So, and there's nothing that Southerners love to do than say that they have a better idea on how they are to be portrayed than other people. But there's some great Southern films and great Southern filmmakers that have come about. One of which I'm really excited about is Joey Lauren Adams. We not only do we need more female voices in cinema, but man, how about a female voice from Arkansas? Now that's going to be interesting, over her career and what she wants to explore. Same with Philip Morrison, who did Junebug, which I just thought was probably one of the most incredible Southern movies I've seen in close to a decade. And, Peter Taylor, the local Memphis author, was asked, why are there so many good Southern storytellers? And he said, well, we lost. And I know what he means by that, because I think that both whites and blacks in the South feel that we're kind of doomed and damned to be our only friends. I don't think it's as easy as you can take a black man from Mississippi and assume that he's just going to get along with a black man from Jersey over a white boy from the South. So I, as much as some of those intersections and collisions between race and gender and class have led to some horrible things in the South's past, it's also led to Booker T and the MGs. It's also led to Johnny Cash. It's also led to Rufus Thomas and B.B. King and Otis Redding having the best white engineer in the world, you know, record his voice. It seems like when we get creative or we get spiritual or if we get hungry, we forget about everything. The fear of the unknown, the fear of, you know, Blind Lemon Jefferson, born in Texas, died a horrible death in Chicago when after a gig in a snowstorm, he got lost and froze to death, which really is sad considering, like, that's how he always thought he was going to go out. He was always singing about scorpions or snakes or bugs being in his room and not being able to see it. And could some pretty mama please come get this black snake, you know, and It's also a very wicked old song. There's something even about the scratches and pops in the album that, in the simplistic guitar playing and that howl, that oh, black snake on him, that just sends chills down your spine. So, you know, the most powerful thing about blues that I've found is I think it's like rap. I think it's exorcism music. Rap artists dance between their reality and fantasy. And I think it's a very important thing to articulate those things. You know, Mississippi Fred McDowell in North Mississippi would have a line, well, I'm going to buy me a bulldog and chain it in my front yard, and that'll keep my woman from sneaking off at night. Now, I don't think Mississippi Fred really bought a bulldog and really chained it in his front yard, but I think he felt that way. And I think that blues music, was, you know, just like rap, is taking those fears, taking those anxieties, and articulating them over and over again, sometimes three times in a verse, and then you somehow get control over it instead of it controlling you. And if you just have a bad, you know, week, and you go into the weekend, and you're hell-bent on some personal destruction, and you go to a juke, and you're drinking, and you're listening to the music, and everybody's up and dancing, you feel better. You feel exhausted. You drop to, into your bed and you wake up the next morning and now it's time for church and it's kind of the same thing, but now it's like switched. It's no longer about screwing and fighting and drinking and now it's more about Jesus and God, but everybody's still sweating and dancing and singing.
You mentioned Skip James earlier that you were listening to. I'm watching this movie. I thought that Skip James's voice.
Yeah.
And you weren't able to get any.
Well, the thing is that, you know, Skip, God bless him, I just felt that this was more of a movie about Mississippi and Tennessee, and I felt that Son House, being a man who was a preacher and who used to hear that music coming up from the juke and go, well, isn't that scandalous? Couldn't stay away from women and couldn't stay away from liquor and you know, ended up going to jail for killing a man. And you know, he is the blues. He's the man that can't stay away from that kind of pain.
John and Stephanie mentioned that a lot of people did not want this to be a second film. Can you talk about your relationship with them and the supportiveness of that when you do this film as well as do your own editing cuts?
I tell people I'm like the child of two divorced parents that are very different. You know, they John Singleton's kind of like the yeah go man no put the chain on her, you know, throw, you know, and Stephanie's more of the, you know, now Craig, you know, let's think about this, and you know, and I kind of dance in between the two. But really, I think that especially both of them, you know, Stephanie who gave John a start at Columbia, and they've both worked in those studio situations, I think really feel that we have an opportunity to kind of create something new. There really isn't a category I could put Hustle and Flow in. Luckily, because it's rap and because there are African Americans in it, America can say, well, it's an urban film, which I think is something I know that I have a problem with that category. I know it's necessary to some extent, but I have a hard time necessarily putting something like Eve's Bayou next to Belly just because there's African Americans in the leads. But with Hustle, I think people could just put it under that category and not think of it as a comedy or a drama or anything. This movie is a little bit more difficult. People laugh at this movie and also are moved by the movie, and they wonder if I'm somehow being disrespectful because I have funny moments in it. I've been at funerals in the South where the most inappropriate shit would happen, and everybody busts up, and then it passes, and we're back into the wake, you know, and that's just part of it. We're attracted to the grotesque and the outrageous. Sometimes they're members of our family, and they're hard not to love.
You mentioned that you could just sort of define categories. I wonder how the town perceives you. What kind of screenplays do you get set? Do you read screenplays, or do you generate your own?
I always write my own scripts. I've not read any scripts for me to consider directing, but I now have a company called Southern Cross the Dog. And at Paramount, and we're trying to produce things that, you know, I want to see more working class movies. You know, I want to see a return to movies like, I would call Purple Rain a working class movie. You know, even though that's a big entertaining musical romp, you know, those people didn't have any money. You know, they were still struggling from gig to gig, and you know, movies like Urban Cowboy and Officer and a Gentleman. You know, there used to be a time where the only goal was Richard Gere just needed to graduate. It got into the 80s, and it was like, you need to graduate and then shoot down some MiGs. You know, that's the Top Gun version. So I'm sorry. Any other questions?
Yeah. How come there was no deleted scenes on the Hustle?
Man, I shot that movie in 24 days. I mean, whatever I chopped up went into that stew, you know? I mean, I didn't have much that I could really let fall by the wayside, but Black Snake Moan has a lot of really good deleted scenes.
John said you actually have some Hustle scenes to put in an upcoming new special edition.
There's two that are pretty good. Yeah, there's a few.